This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Welcome to Resolve Mystery!
Hi! Woo.
This is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to the cases featured on the show Unsolved Mysteries. I'm Allison.
I'm Eliza.
I'm Carlin.
Welcome to the show. So as most of you know, for every review that we receive, we donate a dollar to a different organization. And this month's organization is the Epilepsy Foundation. Our patron Ruth wrote to us and said, in 2007, my 11-year-old sister passed away from SUPDEP, or sudden unexpected death in epilepsy.
No.
There are 3.4 million people in this country alone with active epilepsy. One in six will have a seizure in their lifetime. One-third of all people with epilepsy live with uncontrollable seizures because there is no effective treatment for them. And 6 out of 10 people live with the cause of their seizures unknown. So like I said, this was suggested to us by our patron Ruth, and we're going to be donating in her sister Veronica's name this month. Aww. So if you want to leave us a review, do something nice for us, and we'll do something nice for the Epilepsy Foundation.
Yeah, and Ruth, I'm so sorry.
And
so
thanks for writing to us about that. Yeah. People write to us about such personal, beautiful things. Mm-hmm. So, Eliza, would you like to shout out some of our new patron family?
Oh, my goodness. These sweeties, of course. Thank you to Laura R., Laura, Carol, Britt D., Kim O., Abigail B., Lisa D., Caitlin P., and Allison C.
I became a patron.
Oh,
I know. I was like,
nice of you, honey.
When I typed that, I was like, ooh, look, it's me.
Thanks, honeys.
Thanks. Thank you so much, guys. We really appreciate it. If you'd like to support us on Patreon, you'll get access to ad-free episodes, 2 additional episodes a month, early access to listener short stacks, along with goodies in the mail, and so many other things. We have something really awesome going over on our Patreon right now, but we can't talk about it. But if you're a patron, you know, and we're so excited about it. And just to let you guys know, we said it a couple times, but we're going to keep saying it so you're not surprised. We'll be going on summer hiatus from July 26th to August 25th. But patrons are still going to get short stacks, and they're going to get some extra content. So they're basically still going to have an episode every week that we're on the break. And also, I just counted, and we have over 50 Patreon short stack episodes on there now.
What?
Nice.
Yeah. So if you're a patron, you can binge those while we're on our break, too. It's like over 40 hours worth of content.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
That's unbelievable.
We never stop talking about Unsolved Mysteries. Also, oh yeah, I wanted to let you guys know that I recently discovered that we had an issue with our Contact Us page on our Squarespace site. So it was going to our spam email, and it's been happening since February. It's really embarrassing. So if you wrote to us between February and May and we didn't read your listener short stack or you didn't get a reply from us, it's because we didn't get the email. A million apologies. Truly humiliating. But if you wrote to us and you want us to read something on a listener short stack, please resubmit it.
Yes.
What you gonna do? You know, it's just the way of the pod. It's just how the pod goes.
Truly.
Okay, so what are we covering this episode?
Well, the first segment is a missing persons, and it's several people. It's Baron 52 is the name of the segment.
And then I have a wanted segment of a true dick bitch, mm-hmm. Paul Stamper.
And I have a wanted segment of a scam, fraudy, nasty lady, Josephine White.
All right, ready?
Let's go.
So this is the missing persons segment about Baron 52. And the first clip we see is a soldier getting off a plane returning from Vietnam. And he just jumps out and gets on the ground and kisses the ground. Mm. And Stack says, 18 years ago, families across the country were rejoicing as their husbands and sons began coming home from the distant jungles of Southeast Asia. They show more videos of soldiers reuniting with their families, and they're just too nice. Mm-hmm. It makes you want to cry from the first few seconds. On January 27, 1973, the Paris Peace Accords had been formally ratified. There would be no more American involvement in Vietnam. But for some families, the war would never end. While other soldiers still stationed overseas were writing joyful letters to their wives and girlfriends back home, Air Force Sergeant Peter Cressman was writing to his congressman. So they do a voiceover reenactment of Cressman reading his letter, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's from the letter directly, and it says, "Dear Sir, I read the headlines which hailed the Peace with Honor Agreement, only to wake the next morning to find my situation the same as the day before, as though nothing had changed in Southeast Asia. Feeling that I must have missed some of the small print of the agreement, I again read it and found that I had not overlooked anything that was on the printed page. It was then that I realized that I and others in my unit were in violation of an agreement which I consider to be an order from the Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of the United States." Hmm. Stack then tells us that Peter Cressman was the youngest of three brothers to serve during the Vietnam conflict, which we've seen this before where it's like the whole family is in the war. He was an electronics expert who flew top-secret reconnaissance missions. Quote, "Every day since the ceasefire, his squadron had continued to operate as if nothing had changed." So they continue the voiceover of Cressman's letter, and he says, "There I was informed of the consequences of refusing to carry out the orders, which I consider to be illegal as well as amoral. These consequences instilled a fear which has caused me to abandon any thoughts of refusing to obey these illegal orders." So February 4th, 1973, 1 week after the ceasefire, Peter Cressman and seven other men boarded an EC-47Q surveillance plane codenamed Baron 52. So on Baron 52 were the 361st Tactical Electronic Warfare Squadron, which were Captain George R. Spitz, the pilot, Second Lieutenant Severo J. Prim III, co-pilot, Captain Arthur R. Bollinger, navigator, First Lieutenant Robert E. Bernhardt, third pilot, and then the 6,994th Security Squadron was Sergeant Todd M. Melton, radio operator, Sergeant Joseph A. Matajov, radio operator, Sergeant Peter R. Cressman, radio operator, and Sergeant Dale Brandenburg, systems repair technician. So Stack explains that Cressman and the other electronics experts would sit in the rear of the plane. The flight plan for Baron 52 had them proceed from Ubon Air Force Base in Thailand into Laos, quote, a neutral country which borders Vietnam and Cambodia. There were a group of North Vietnamese tanks moving into Cambodia along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and they were supposed to monitor them. So essentially, Cressman and Matajov, they were basically supposed to like tap in and eavesdrop on what they were doing. At 11.05 p.m., Baron 52 departed. 2.5 hours later, reports came in that the plane was receiving heavy ground fire. 5 minutes later, radio transmissions ceased. 2 days later, the wreckage of Baron 52 was located in the jungle of Laos. A rescue team recovered the remains of only the co-pilot, which isn't really true, what they say in UM. There's a little bit more that was found. Missing in action were Peter Cressman and six other men, three officers and three electronics experts, including 21-year-old Joseph Matajov. Matajov's father died in 1984, but his mother remembers every detail. So Mary Matajov, Joe's mother, is interviewed quite a bit in the segment, and she says that an officer and a sergeant came to their home to tell them that Joe was missing in action. They told them that the plane had been shot down, but there was a possibility that some of the men had bailed out of the plane. She says this gave her a little bit of relief because Joe was missing and not killed, and she thought there was a chance she might see him again. 18 days later, February 23, 1973, they returned and informed them that none of the men had gotten out of the plane because they were not wearing parachutes, and the plane had gone down in a spin, so none of them could have possibly gotten out. So all the men were declared killed in action. They told the Matajovs that they did see remains in the plane and that the plane had been burned. Quote, "So we believed them," says Mary. Peter Cressman's mother, Evelyn Cressman, had also been told that her son's status had been changed from missing in action to killed in action. Evelyn says that if the government told her her son had been killed in action, she'd believe them because they wouldn't go around just telling families that this had happened unless they had positive proof. A few weeks later, the Air Force sent Cressman's personal belongings to his parents. They found the letter there he had written to his congressman, but never sent. So they get this after they find out that he's killed in action and that this whole thing was, like, not a good mission. Yeah. Stack tells us that Peter's father passed away in 1989, but he and his sons had always questioned the status change from missing to killed. So finding the letter only served to heighten their suspicions. So we have an interview with Peter's brother, Pat, who says that the military was declaring him dead, but there was no body. He says he knows bodies can burn up or disappear in combat, but in this case, there was just nothing. He also says that because of the classification of the missions, they didn't have anything to back up their position. Stack says that for about 5 years, the Cressmans wrote to various Air Force officials seeking specific details about their son's case. The Air Force reported consistently that because of the condition of the wreckage and the fact that there was no distress call, there would not have been enough time for the flight crew to bail out. The official Air Force reports stated that all of the crew of Baron 52 were killed in the crash. So I think commonly if you hear no communication at all, it's because people are not there anymore.
Yeah.
In June of 1978, the Cressmans received a surprising phone call from an attorney from the National Missing in Action Organization. He told the family that there was evidence indicating that at least four of the men of the aircraft survived, but were also captured by the North Vietnamese forces. The attorney said that an investigative journalist named Jack Anderson had written a report and claimed that U.S. intelligence intercepted a North Vietnamese communique shortly after Baron 52 crashed. In 1973, Terrell Minarson was an air defense analyst for the National Security Agency. His job was to decipher intercepted North Vietnamese messages. So we have Minarson interviewed, and he says that they saw a specific North Vietnamese communique requesting transportation for captured American bandit pilots. He explains that because of the ceasefire, they felt confident that that the only Americans captured then would have been those from Baron 52. And we'll get into it, but not everything calls out the American part in that communication,
okay,
which is part of why this gets confusing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So he explains that parachutes were missing from the plane, so there was a good chance that some of the men did survive because their parachutes were not there and neither were they.
I kind of thought they had found all the parachutes and that's why they said, oh, they must have not bailed out.
Yeah.
Totally.
But it is, how does a plane with seven people go down and you only find one person?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't just one person.
Okay.
So we'll talk about that, but
okay.
Agree with you that it's weird that it would be some people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he says that they probably parachuted out of the plane. Then he says they know that they were already taken into the hands of the Vietnamese and put in the prison system. He's saying this because of that communique that they heard. Mary Matajov says, my husband, a dedicated military man, we were certainly dedicated to serving our country. But Mary says as soon as she told her husband about what she'd heard, he immediately said that they should go to the Pentagon and pull Joe's file out and study it themselves to see what really happened.
Ugh.
I know. So they do. They go there and they have a reenactment of them. You know, they're given the file and they're given like a little time in this room. And Mary says there were copies of the radio intercepts. But as we all could have guessed, many of the lines and sometimes whole pages are just blacked out.
Redacted.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Mary says there wasn't much they could read, quote, but we saw enough evidence in his file to show that the government knew all along that these four men had been captured. So, and I wish they would tell us what
they
did see in there, because that would give us a lot more clarity about why they really grabbed onto this so much.
Yeah.
My husband didn't want to be bitter, but it was beginning to hurt him more and more. I would hear him at night when he thought I was asleep, and I could hear him sometimes cry, and he would mutter, Joe. No, it never got off his mind, and he was very much hurt by the whole issue.
So sad.
I can imagine when you are a military man your whole life.
Yeah.
And then you feel like
you believe in the system.
Literally stole your son.
Yeah.
Stack says, the Defense Intelligence Agency does not deny the existence of a North Vietnamese communique. However, the DIA claims the nationality of the captured pilots was never specified. Consequently, they determined that the prisoners were not the crew members of the Baron 52. So they're saying, yes, this communique happened. This is what it said, but they weren't talking about those soldiers. Mm. So in 1986, Jerry Mooney, a retired intelligence analyst, testified in front of Congress that Peter Kressman and Joseph Matijov were prisoners of war, but not in Southeast Asia. He claimed that they had been transported to the Soviet Union. Terrell Minarson agrees with this theory that the men could have been taken to the USSR. Quote, special types of prisoners with special knowledge, special experience, were being rounded up throughout the various prison war camps throughout North Vietnam and sent to Hanoi to be turned over to the Russians for exploitation.
Huh. Weird.
So, if they were useful to them,
yeah.
I guess.
But you know what's weird about that is I just listened to the John McCain series on, what's it called, that show that we love?
Against All Odds.
Yeah, Against All Odds. And he was in Hanoi for like 5 years and remembered when the Paris Accord was signed and the Hanoi, they let them go like very soon after. And he had lots that the Russians could have exploited him for, like because of who his father was. And so it's like, why did they let them go? All these men who'd been in there for years and years and years. But then they capture these people after the Paris Accords are signed to exploit. It's just like, what?
Yeah. No, it really doesn't add up, in my opinion, for that to have happened, for them to go to Moscow or whatever.
Yeah.
So from that point, they were flown from Hanoi across northern Laos and northern Burma to India for refueling and up to Moscow. Minarson says they had information stating they had been flown out to the Sokol area. Stack tells us there is no concrete evidence that the POWs were transferred to Russia during the Vietnam conflict, but he says that the Russians have recently pledged to look through their penal system in the unlikely event that any Americans were ever brought to their country. And I found no other mention of that at all in my research, so I do not believe that went anywhere. Stack tells us that the question that haunts the families of the missing soldiers is, if the government had knowledge that their sons had been captured, why had their status been changed to killed in action? Stack says that according to Mrs. Matijov, the answer could be found at the Paris peace talks. Mary says her husband made arrangements to talk to Dr. Roger Shields, the Assistant Secretary of Defense at the Paris peace talks. Shields told him that he was ordered to cross off the names of the men from the EC-47Q from a government list of known live captured Americans and to write killed in action over them.
Oh, that's bananas, if that's true.
Mary says, quote, this plane was flying after the peace treaty was signed, therefore it was breaking the peace treaty. It was a covert operation. They were flying over Laos, and at that time we said we were not in war with Laos, but we were having a secret war, and there was secret bombing going on. But we couldn't admit to that, so the only thing they could do was just wipe these men out as if they never existed, and that's what they did. So he was actually killed on paper at the Paris peace talks.
Oh, that's terrible.
So Stack says that Roger Shields declined to appear on camera, but he did get on the phone with UM. And he stated that he was never ordered to cross off the names, and in fact, he never had authority to do a status change. But he said that Mrs. Matijov had every reason in the world to believe her son might still be alive.
That's a very interesting statement.
Who is he lying to?
Yeah.
Somebody's lying. Somebody's
lying. He's clearly trying to communicate that they might be alive. Otherwise, he never would have.
Exactly.
Otherwise, he never would have said that.
Totally. Why would he even insert himself in this?
He didn't have to say that at all.
Yeah. So Mary says, a man who puts on a uniform to serve his country should be brought back once he serves and brought back to his loved ones. So I like to speak out about that. Make sure whatever you do that you don't let this happen again. God forbid there should ever be another war and other men forgotten. Evelyn Kressman says, we didn't expect this kind of thing from the government, to be perfectly honest. And I had someone ask me once, do you consider yourself patriotic? As though the information I was telling them about me made me unpatriotic. Well, if something goes wrong in your family, you do what you can to straighten it out. You admit to what the problem is. And obviously, I don't believe they have admitted to this day what the problem is. Mm. And I thought that was a powerful statement, too.
Yeah.
Because it's like people blindly agree with everything.
Yes. And it's like,
problems.
You know what? I was patriotic until they proved to me that I shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
And she was trying to say, I still am, but something is wrong here. It's okay for me to call out that something is wrong here.
Exactly.
It doesn't mean I hate my country because I want the problems of the country to be fixed.
Yeah.
Totally. Or because you think that they're lying to you.
Like, yeah.
So Stack says, for nearly 20 years, both the Air Force and the Defense Department have stood by the classifications of Peter Kressman and Joseph Matijov as killed in action. However, there was one odd footnote to this story. At the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C., 7 of the 8 crewmen who were lost on Baron 52, including Kressman and Matijov, were inexplicably listed as missing in action. Which to me, I was like, if that's how they were originally documented, yeah. I don't think that's that crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very unfortunate, but...
We've seen previously in other segments that we've covered. This really reminds me of the Mark Dennis segment that mm-hmm. I covered last season. But they weren't the best at paperwork.
No.
You know, there was a lot of stuff going on. There were so many casualties. Yeah. And there were many people that were assumed to be dead and people that were prisoners of war and then people that were actually dead and identified. And boxes are going to get checked incorrectly. So there was so much volume of chaos to weed through that you're gonna miss some stuff along mm-hmm. the way, you know.
Totally. And I think that is like the original issue with this whole thing, that we weren't there in that forest in Laos. Like,
no.
Nobody was but them. Yeah. Nobody was but them. So how can we know?
Yeah.
So this case is very beefy. For many reasons for me, this type of case is hard to report on because there's just so much detail that's kind of hard to absorb. And there's a lot of he said this, they said this, mm-hmm. this info contradicts this info type of stuff. So I'm really, like, boiling it down to the, like, major key points of the timeline because it's just a lot. So just to fill in a little bit about the original recovery efforts that UM didn't put in, like I said, I have an excerpt from Wikipedia because it summarizes it well, and I did find all this info elsewhere, but it was just already written out here. So the location of the wreckage was first discovered by U.S. Air Force Search and Rescue on 7th of February, 1973. The plane was determined to have crashed inverted, coming to rest upside down in the jungle, and both wings had been sheared off.
Whoa.
So, which is why it, like, spun. Mm. A team consisting of 3 pararescue men and an intelligence expert were on the ground for approximately an hour and found 3 bodies in the charred wreckage. Those of Spitz, Prim, and Bollinger in the cockpit, still strapped in their seats.
Oh, wow.
So those ones were always from the beginning killed in action. Like, those ones never changed. I don't know why UM said one.
Yeah.
Yeah, they said just the co-pilot.
Very weird. I don't get why, because everywhere else says these 3 men. Outside the wreckage, they found Lieutenant Bernhardt's body. In the rear of the plane, they observed that the jump door had been removed. Mm. So it wasn't just open, it was gone.
Okay.
The crew's safety belts were unbuckled. So again, it's not like they just combusted or something like that. The mm-hmm. belts were open, mm-hmm. which is another, like, huge point of this. And all of the top secret sensitive equipment was missing, as were the rear crew's parachutes. So it appears like maybe they left.
I wonder, is that part of protocol? If you do jump, you take the information that you can with you?
I was reading something about that, yeah.
Okay.
Especially, like, sensitive equipment and stuff, they would try to take it with them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. On the 9th of February, 1973, Bernhardt's remains were recovered. So it was 2 days in between the 4th body being found mm-hmm. And positively identified 4 days later. On 22nd February, the other 7 men were declared killed in action despite no confirmation of the fates of the 4 members of the collection crew. So the segment aired in 91, and at that point, the last piece of the timeline we got was that part about Roger Shields, the Assistant Secretary of Defense, mm-hmm. at the peace talks, allegedly telling Mrs. Matijov that he'd been ordered to cross out the names. Mm-hmm. As we know, Mr. Matijov passed away in the 80s, so he wasn't alive when UM aired, but Mrs. Matijov was on it, and she continued the search and the fight for the son that she felt was missing in action. Yeah. And Joe Matijov's 9 siblings also joined in the effort.
Gosh.
Yeah. Some of them were military as well. Mm. I'm really surprised there was not an update included in this segment because lots of stuff happened within, like, a few years of this era. Oh. So I don't know why they sometimes just don't circle
just
back
leave
on
it
stuff.
Out. Yeah.
Well, that's what we're for.
Yeah, that's what we're here for. So the segment aired in 91. In 1993, the crash site was reinvestigated by a joint U.S. Laotian field excavation team, and the partial remains of seven men were discovered.
Oof. Oh.
It took a couple years to complete their investigation, so the info comes out a little bit later. So there was a Washington Post article from 1995 written by Thomas W. Lippman titled, "Mystery of the Last Flight of Baron 52 Solved." So the article discusses that for many years, family members of the crew and MIA activists have believed that the four men of Baron 52 were captured and taken to Moscow. The article states that, quote, "the remains of the seven men killed when the reconnaissance aircraft was shot down over Laos in 1973 have been identified and will be interred in a group burial on January 8th, the Pentagon said. They state that if all seven members of the crew died, then four could not have been taken captive. The article discusses that the belief that the crew members were captured was based mostly on the testimony from Air Force Intelligence Sergeant Jerry Mooney and his statement about the radio communication about the captured Americans. Mm-hmm. The Pentagon always insisted no one could have survived the crash and that the intercepted communication was not about Baron 52. But the lack of remains or any proof of death was always the sticking point for the families. The Pentagon always said there was just no proof in the communication that specifically linked Baron 52. In 1993, Mark Sauter and Jim Sanders authored a book called The Men We Left Behind about the alleged POW MIA cover-up. The whole book is about how the men were not dead and the Pentagon knew they weren't dead, and they said the reason for this was because the flight itself was illegal under the Paris Agreement. The names were scratched from the list because they were an inconvenience that would have complicated Henry Kissinger's life, their book said. Kissinger, then Secretary of State, had negotiated the Paris Agreements and was responsible for fulfilling President Richard Nixon's promise that all U.S. prisoners would be coming home. So, but the part that's weird to me is that nobody ever denies this mission was happening. Everybody talks about it. Everybody knows it was, like, planned. Like, nobody's, like...
So why cover up the men if everyone knows the plane was in there?
Yeah.
That part just doesn't make any sense, and I don't get why that's not brought up more.
Well, and couldn't they make... So is it believed for sure that they were shot down?
Yes, because a plane was found with those three bodies inside and one body outside.
But, I mean, not from just a crash. They believe the North Vietnamese shot them down.
Yes.
Because you'd think if they were really like, oh, we weren't in agreement, weren't also the North Vietnamese not in agreement for not listening to the ceasefire and shooting the plane down? Or were they allowed to do that? I don't know.
That part I don't know and I don't understand either.
Yeah. And is part of the belief that they were covering it up, too, because they were mad at him for writing that that letter to his congressman?
But he never sent it.
He didn't send it,
so I don't think they even knew about it.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So this excavation team finds remains in 1993. They find a dog tag with Matajov's name on it laying in plain sight, which was pointed out was 20 years later, which is weird.
Yeah.
They find a lot of bone fragments. This number ranges from 23 to 31. I don't know how many it really was. And they also found a part of a tooth. They also found zippers, fasteners, pieces of flight gear, and sidearms. So a lot of people thought those zippers and fasteners were parts of parachutes. Mm-hmm. It takes 2 years of work at the Army's forensic lab in Hawaii, but they ultimately determined to have found the remains of Sergeant Dale Brandenburg of Capitol Heights, Peter R. Cressman of Glen Ridge, New Jersey, Joseph A. Matajov of East Meadow, New York, and Todd M. Melton of Milwaukee. First Lieutenant Severo J. Prim, the third of New Orleans, Captain George R. Spitz of Asheville, North Carolina, and Captain Arthur Bullinger of Greenville, Illinois. Apparently, Ellis R. Curley, who was a forensic anthropologist who was involved in a lot of high-profile investigations, like specifically for the purpose of identifying human remains, he worked on the cases for the Challenger space shuttle, the Jonestown massacre, and JFK, just to name a few.
Oh, wow.
So he was, like... big time.
Wow.
So Curley had made a statement that the bone fragments, quote, cannot be proven conclusively to be human. But then Curley was replaced by an Army colonel who was actually just a dentist with limited forensic experience.
Oh boy.
I know. I don't know why. I don't know what that's about. So one thing I read said that the families requested DNA testing and the government denied the request. Another thing I read said that the families didn't want DNA testing done, but that seems highly unlikely.
No. Why not? It would just give you an answer. If they're searching for answers, that's the best way to get one.
Yeah.
Yes. Stars and Stripes is a U.S. military independent newspaper, and they stated that the remains could not be tested. So, I don't know.
Who knows?
Maybe they were too degraded or the technology wasn't good enough. I have no clue. In 1996, the bone fragments were interred at Arlington National Cemetery in a group burial. All of the families of the crew attended the service, but the families of the four men believed to be captured still stated they did not believe the fragments were those of their family members and said they were only there to pay respects to the men who were positively identified in the plane. Hmm. So I don't know if the families didn't believe it because the DNA testing wasn't done or if they had other specific reasons to believe that it was not a positive identification. But either way, they did not believe the reports. And for Cressman specifically, the issue was that the tooth fragment, which they said was his, was based on dental x-rays. And his brother, Bob, said that the Air Force records showed two full rows of teeth. Mm-hmm. But he's like, that can't be my brother's records because some of his teeth had been knocked out and he wore a dental plate.
Oh.
So he really hung on to that and was like, that's not... It's not a positive ID.
Yeah.
In 2007, the family received what they considered a lengthy runaround regarding a Baron 52 review from the DPAA's predecessor agencies, the Defense POW/Missing Personnel Office, and the Joint POW/MIA Accounting Command. But the years of persistence finally won them an opportunity to present their case directly to Michael Linnington, the DPAA director, and Brigadier General Mark Spindler, the deputy director. The Matajovs went prepared with a presentation of witnesses, experts, and declassified military documents put together with about a decade's worth of pro bono work by a sympathetic Washington law firm.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, this family spent all of their time for years doing this. The DPAA leaders listened for 2 hours and agreed to send a recommendation on the change of status to the Air Force by mid-April. So the whole thing here for the family was that if he could just be declared MIA, the military would have to try and account for him.
Like,
they just didn't like that this is, we just don't know. Like, we want at least someone to try to find him.
Okay.
So, and they would also at that point have to admit that they made a mistake when they first declared him KIA, killed in action.
Yeah.
Quote, I honestly don't believe he is alive, but he didn't die in the crash, his sister Teresa Freese, 56, said. We just want the truth. We want the case to remain open and be looking for him, because we don't believe he came home. So over the years, the Matajov and Cressman families doggedly wrote letters, asked for meetings, and spoke out about their soldiers' cases. In 2010, Mary Matajov passed away, but the siblings, the nine siblings, continued the fight for Joe.
Wow.
Interestingly, one of Joe's sisters lived in Oregon, at least at for a time. So I found an Oregonian article from 2014 written by Mike Francis about families of those missing in war and a briefing from the military about the efforts to find them. It said that 200 people had met at the embassy suites in downtown Portland for a regional briefing. Quote, the families were gathered for a regional briefing by members of the Defense Department's Prisoner of War Missing Personnel Office, the agency charged with locating, identifying, and recovering remains or evidence about military members whose fates were unknown. Agency officials periodically invite family members of the missing to attend briefings to hear or offer information about their cases, which I didn't know was a thing.
No.
And it said, Saturday's briefing reached events as far back as 72 years when America entered World War II.
Whoa.
In a room of heartbreaking stories, Mary Salzinger of Portland brought a demand. Turn over the untranslated text of intercepted radio messages that describe the capture of four Americans, one of whom may have been her brother, Air Force Senior Airman Joseph Matajov. She delivered a written request under the Freedom of Information Act to a staffer Saturday. Quote, I believe he's still alive, said John Matajov, Joseph's one-year younger brother who lives in Wyoming. Only because my government hasn't shown me that he's not. Ugh. Roger Shields, the guy we mentioned earlier, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for POW Missing Personnel at the time Matajov's plane was downed, said Saturday from his home in New Jersey that he thought the Air Force acted precipitously to declare Matajov and the other three missing crew members to be dead. Shields said the intercepted messages, which occurred soon after the plane crash and described a scene no farther than 40 miles away, were very, very unusual. Quote, one thing I feel strongly about is that if I had been in the Air Force and I was assigned to this case, he said, I would have gone with MIA status. So he, decades later, is still like,
yeah,
this isn't right.
Yeah.
John Matijov has enlisted the help of Wyoming's congressmen and two senators to demand answers from the Pentagon. He and his siblings have hired lawyers and investigators. He wrote a letter to President Obama on Veterans Day last year. So this is, again, 2014. Mm-hmm. Last year, after watching him lay a wreath on the Tomb of the Unknowns. He, his sister, and other members of the family are waiting for answers to a multitude of questions. Why was the government in such a hurry to declare all eight airmen were killed in action? Why do internal military reports contain contradictions about the plane's impact? Why were the radio intercepts never fully described to the families? Why did the military refuse to conduct DNA tests on some recovered bone fragments that may not have been human? The case is controversial, acknowledges Portland Salzinger, who is 6 years younger than her missing brother, but she says it's time for the government to be as forthcoming as it can about the case of Baron 52, as her brother's aircraft was known. Could he be alive? I believe it's possible, but wherever he is, she said, I hope he's at peace. And this is still from that article. Reams have been written about the mysteries associated with the case, as a web search for Baron 52 will show. Other families, notably the family of Sergeant Peter Cressman, also missing from the back of the plane, have pressed for information. Hearings have been conducted on Capitol Hill. An inspector general report was launched but abandoned, said John Matijov. To be sure, others have described the Baron 52 controversy as mythology. Robert J. Destat, a former analyst in the Defense Intelligence Agency, has said the prisoners described in the intercepted radio message were Lao fighters. Hmm. So, like, why is that part not
clear?
Clear. Yeah. Why?
Yeah.
Whether his brother is alive or dead, John Matijov says the government has handled the mystery of his disappearance badly. Quote, all we're trying to do is restore the honor of his loss, John Matijov said by phone Friday. There's no honor in the way this case was handled. Mm-hmm. So the following November 2016, another article from Stars and Stripes reported that they said they would not re-examine the case and the status of Baron 52 would not be changed to MIA.
Wow.
Quote, the present members of the accounting agency and those staff at the Secretary of Air Force who have, as of yesterday, decided not to reopen the Baron 52 case should be ashamed of themselves in rendering this decision, John Matijov said. Mm. It is a sad day all around for all who wear the uniform, past, present, and future. Matijov said he will now write to President Barack Obama and request the president make an executive action to change his brother's status from missing in action. In my view, this is nothing more than a silly chess game between the Defense Department and POW-MAI families. Matijov wrote, through much dogged pursuit, our family at least got a chance to present, but to no avail. Wow. So as of September 2020, the entire crew is listed by the Defense POW-MAI Accounting Agency as accounted for. Whoa. So it's still that way. So John Matijov, the brother, also apparently made a three-part documentary called On the Blood of My Brother. And this is from a letter John wrote to a POW-MIA organization. I have become more and more convinced that the reason our family has been denied a fair review is that it would lead everyone to the salient and sad truth that those four crew members were known to have been captured alive and then intentionally abandoned. There is no other explanation that makes any sense. Joe's KIA status stands as a gross injustice to the honor of his service to this country. And then I found another letter he had written to Trump in 2019, also asking him to intervene. And of course, like, the response from Trump was like, we've passed this on to the proper department and, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So with their identification, the list of servicemen still officially missing from the war stands at 2,162.
Wow.
The vast majority are known to have died, and real doubt remains in only about a handful of cases.
I wonder when the last time they were able to successfully identify someone that was MIA.
From that far back?
Yeah. I wonder what their success rate has been. These are the jungles of Laos and Vietnam. And
Oh my God.
That's why it is a little strange that the dog tag was sitting right on top after all of that time, because the vegetation there is so dense. It's truly a rainforest.
Totally. I know.
So, it seems like, under what circumstances would these people ever be found if they are out there?
I know. And I mean, I think, like, yeah, like the sister had said, like, we don't really think he's alive, probably.
No, of course not.
But we just want
to know.
Yeah.
That's so sad.
They want to know if they were abandoned there because they were doing something that was illegal that Cressman was compelled to write to his senator about.
Yeah.
That, to me, the letter from him was like the biggest thing of like, whoa, something shady.
If he had sent that letter, the conspiracy theories would be insane.
Yeah.
It'd be unmanageable if he had sent it, but he didn't. The senator never even saw it.
Yeah.
Was he saying we are not in agreement with the peace talks because you're sending us on this mission or because we're still here or what? What was
he saying?
Yeah,
he was saying basically like if you're still sending us on this mission, then you're not in agreement with the talks.
Then you're in violation, international violation of a treaty, which is
like, why are we still doing this? Why is everybody going home and we're still doing this?
Yeah,
that is so sad. And it's so sad for the families of everyone who was never found of like, oh my God, it's finally over. They're coming home, watching all these other people come home. And then just not only does your family member not come home, but you don't know what happened to them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I know. Like over 2,000 still unfound. That's many more thousands of family members that are broken from this.
God, that's
for
awful.
Decades.
Yeah.
Awful. Yeah, and like part of me, because we've seen so many where they did die in action and the family was just holding on to a kernel of hope. Yes. Mm-hmm. And so I went that way for a little while, but then I was like, the parachute's missing. Oh, the door being missing was people thought that that made it seem like it was kicked off, like them trying to escape.
Yeah.
And just like some of the equipment being gone and stuff, like all of that at least makes it seem like they attempted to jump. Like maybe they died while they jumped, but.
Yeah. Wow.
I get it. I get why these families are holding on to this.
You know? Yeah.
I'm guessing the Cressmans kind of stopped their search a lot earlier than the Matajovs because there wasn't much from them in the last couple decades. But but the Matajovs are still working on it.
Well, good job. That was a beefy.
Wow. Nice work.
Thanks.
True story, I hate my hair. I have the thinnest, flattest, most baby-fine hair that you have ever seen. I also have terrible skin allergies to hair products, and that leaves my scalp super itchy and unhappy. I have tried zillions of products with zero success, but I have recently found products that actually do what they say they're going to do. I know, it's shocking. I've started using Gemist. I took their quick 2-minute quiz and their fancy schmancy algorithm matched me with the best shampoo and conditioner and a scalp balancing bar. I have to admit, I had no idea what a scalp balancing bar was, but I went for it anyway. It removed buildup and soothed the insane itchiness that I get from using hair care products. The shampoo gave my hair actual volume. Crazy, right? And the conditioner left my hair shiny and really soft and not like weighted down and gross. Also, the products smell really good. They put a lot of deliciousness into that scent. I also love the fact that Gemist is owned by a woman. You gotta support the ladies. Most awesome is that if you subscribe, you get 20% off. Right now, our listeners can give Gemist a try and get 20% off their shampoo and conditioner smart subscription. Smart subscribers already save 20% on each order, so this is an amazing deal. Do the math. And with free 2-day shipping, you can have it literally before this weekend. Just visit Gemist.com and get your personalized recommendation and enter mysteries at checkout for 20% off of your subscription and free 2-day shipping. That's Gemist.com, Gemist.com, and enter code mysteries, MYSTERIES, at checkout to get the best hair of your life. Okay, so this is a wanted segment, and it is the story of Paul and Teresa Stamper. November 23rd, 1985, in Kingfisher, Oklahoma, 23-year-old Teresa Stamper left a small dinner party with her new boyfriend, Chris Butler. Stack says that the quiet evening was a pleasant change for Teresa, who had just ended a marriage which was marked by violence and abuse. Unbeknownst to Teresa, her estranged husband, Paul Stamper, was parked nearby, watching her every move through a high-powered telescope. Stack says that night would be a culmination in his reign of terror against his ex-wife.
Ugh.
For 6 months, Paul Stamper stalked Teresa Stamper day and night, waiting for just the right moment to unleash his vengeance. Stack says that Teresa was constantly looking over her shoulder, never knowing where or when her ex-husband would appear. Stack says that Paul Stamper had changed, and he was no longer the man that Teresa had fallen in love with 5 years earlier.
Don't you always wonder how these guys get these girls in the first place? Like, how?
Yeah. Well, that comes up a little bit later. But yeah, it is someone like Paul Stamper, those type of people, because women are capable of doing that kind of stuff too.
Right.
They're so manipulative and they're so incredible at what they do that these weaselly, unattractive men of small stature can wield tremendous physical and emotional power mm-hmm. over women who are would generally be completely out of their league mm-hmm. or partners that would be completely yeah. out of their league. And I'll get into it a little bit later, but Teresa Stamper came from a low-income background with domestic abuse in her family. Mm-hmm. And there are just people that are perfect targets mm-hmm. for people yeah. like Paul Stamper.
That's often what it is, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Stack says that the booming oil business of the 1980s had lured Paul Stamper to Kingfisher County, Oklahoma. Stamper set up a lucrative oil equipment operation and hired 20-year-old Teresa as his secretary. And then Teresa is interviewed, and I have to say that after years of Unsolved Mysteries segments, I was astonished that she wasn't dead. I was assuming that Paul Stamper murdered her.
Same.
Because that's usually how these things go, but it was a nice relief to see that Teresa had survived.
Yeah, I even went back and rewound because I didn't mm-hmm. see the title card when she first started talking. I was like, is this her? I can't believe that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I know. Isn't that sad?
Yeah.
We're just conditioned to assume that the husband murdered the wife.
Oh, yeah.
And in this instance, he would have.
Yes. So
it's amazing that she's still alive.
Yep.
Teresa Stamper says that Paul impressed her. He took her places and they flew a lot of places, and that was different for her. She says that Paul bought her an 82 red Corvette for her birthday and that he liked to spend money and buy nice things. She said that he was a lot of fun and he asked her to marry him, and she said yes because he was nice to her and he was good to her. Stack says that Teresa believed that she was marrying a dynamic young businessman, but in fact, Paul Stamper was a convicted felon with a record for theft, assault, and fraud stretching back to 1974. More recently, his business practices had come under investigation in Oklahoma. Sheriff Danny Graham says there were unconfirmed reports that Paul went out and destroyed some equipment on locations so that those people would call on him and have him come repair it. Stack says that within 6 months, the marriage became a living hell for Teresa. There's a reenactment, and Paul is sitting at a kitchen counter, and Teresa comes into the house, and he smacks the counter when she walks in, and he says, "Mind telling me where you been?" And she says that she was at the grocery store getting dinner, and he starts yelling, "You've been gone for 2 hours. Who were you with?" and accusing her of seeing someone else. And then he starts in, and this is so classic of domestic abusers. "Don't I give you everything? Don't I give you a nice place to live? Don't I buy you nice things? You're ungrateful." And then he hits her, and he tells her that she had better be there when he gets back. The real Paul Stamper is obviously a piece of human garbage, but it was really hard for me to take this reenactor seriously because he looked like Napoleon Dynamite's older brother, Kip.
Yes.
So all I could think of was, like, him with that head wrap and, like, his mustache. And he looked exactly like that actor.
And I always hate how long they spend on these mean guys. Like, the scenes of them being abusive are always so long. And
well, they have to make you hate him.
Scary.
I think, Eliza, I think you're covering one next episode. And I just watched the segment. And it is horrifying.
It traumatizes.
The violence is horrifying. Yeah, I agree. It is. I mean, you have to provide drama and violence in order to get people to be into it, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, that's just how TV is. So Teresa tells us that Paul started watching her, having people follow her, and he wouldn't let her visit her friends. She says one moment he would be nice, and then the next moment he would hit her, and she, quote, didn't know how to handle him. And I feel so bad for her because you can't handle people like Paul Stamper.
And it's nothing you're doing or that you could change or that you could do to make him more calm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. She's doing nothing wrong. Then Teresa says that she could be sitting in a car at a red light with Paul, and if she were to look over at the car next to her out the window and there was a man driving it, Paul would, quote, double up his fist and just hit me right in the mouth.
Yeah.
Teresa says that the level of abuse was unreal. And then, oh my God, they show a photo of her.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I guess it was after a time that Paul had hit her, and she is completely beaten.
Yeah.
Completely. She has two black eyes, bruises along the side of her face, bruises on her cheeks, a bruise on her lower lip, on her chin, and on her forehead. It is unbelievably horrifying.
Yeah, I know. And I was wondering, like, did she take that picture to later prove something, or did...
I think so. I think she might have had her mother take it. Her mother isn't in the UM segment, but her and her mother were very close, and her mother was actively involved in this harassment and abuse as well.
Oh, I just cannot imagine.
So Stack says that Stamper was arrested and charged with assault and battery against his wife 5 times, and that each time the charges were inexplicably dropped. Mm. Teresa says that Stamper bragged to her that he was paying off authorities. Sheriff Danny Graham says that he had heard rumors that there were payoff attempts, but that they looked into a couple of incidents and they could find no basis for it. But there was a lot of talk about it. Go ask the prosecutor what's going on. You don't need to, like, delve in rumors. Go to the prosecutor and say, how has this person not been prosecuted after being arrested 5 times for the same thing? Yeah. We have photographs of this woman covered in bruises. She's being harassed. She ended up taking recordings of him harassing her, and still nothing. Mm. And people wonder why women and men who suffer from domestic abuse don't, quote, do anything about it.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's way too many.
Because what you're going to do is you're going to arrest this person. It's going to make them more angry, and it's going to make them abuse you more, and no one is going to do anything to help you.
Yeah.
It's so fucked up. So Stack says that by the second year of the marriage, the violence reached a frightful climax. On the evening of January 5th, 1985, a man broke into Stamper's home. Teresa was out of town, but a friend was staying over. And the reenactment shows a woman sleeping on a couch.
Oh, my God.
And then the man, she rolls over, looks at the man, and the man starts slashing at her face and her throat. Yes. Maybe the reenactment isn't clear. I was not able to find out who this woman was. And in my research, this story doesn't even really come up again. Oh. But I did read that the woman was violently stabbed and that her throat was slit. And that she survived. But I was never able to find out her name. Stack says that thankfully the friend survived the attack and called the police. The woman later identified the assailant as Gary Trout, a local mechanic who worked for Paul Stamper. They show a photo of Gary Trout, and it is yikes on bikes. He is fucking terrifying. He looks like...
I don't remember what he looked like.
Oh, my God. He looks like if a community theater did a low-budge version of Sons of Anarchy. That's what he looks like. He's... Oh, my God. He's a bootleg version of Sons of Anarchy.
Oh, he's so gross.
Oh, dear. So, Sheriff Danny Graham says that Gary Trout told him that Paul Stamper had... asked Gary to kill his wife and was willing to pay $5,000 up front and $5,000 to finish it. Stack says that Stamper was arrested and charged as an accessory to the attempted murder, but when Gary Trout's case went to court, Trout wouldn't finger Stamper. I know, it's terrible, but I giggle. Once again, all charges against Stamper were dropped. Meanwhile, Teresa moved in with her parents, yet never felt completely safe. It says moved in with her parents, but I believe that it was just her mother. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Stamper threatened Teresa repeatedly, and on the night of September 13th, 1984, he shot out Teresa's bedroom window. And when she went to the window, he revved the engine, looked at her, and drove off, as if, like, he wanted her to know.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Teresa reported the incident to the sheriff's department, but again, nothing was done. Mm. What is happening here? I don't know. I should have looked up who the prosecutor was
this
at the
time. This woman could have been killed several times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they couldn't possibly show that they care less.
Yes. Yes.
I don't know how to say that correctly, but, like, you've had so many opportunities to try.
Yes. Yes. To, like, pretend to muster a fox.
Just pretend.
Yes. Well, and the sad thing is I found out, because at first I was, like, a little annoyed with Sheriff Graham as well, kind of like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. But all he can do is arrest someone. It's not up to him whether or not charges are filed and whether or not they're prosecuted. And I did find out that he and Teresa Stamper ended up developing a pretty close relationship, and he stuck by her through a lot of this and did what he could to help her. Mm. So Teresa was separated from Stamper for more than a year, and despite the continued harassment from Stamper, she tried to put her life back together. Then came the night of November 23rd, 1985. That evening, Teresa and her boyfriend, Chris Butler, had left the dinner party at around 11:30 p.m. Teresa says that they were driving down the highway and they saw police lights behind them, which is my biggest fear.
Oh, my God. Totally.
Oh, my God. It always makes me think of the Hillside Stranglers when someone does that, when someone pretends to be a police officer in a police car.
Horrifying.
And the fact that you can buy those lights online, anywhere.
It's not okay. I know.
It's not okay. So fucked up.
I know.
So we know that the patrolman is obviously Paul, but they didn't know that. Ugh. So Butler pulls over, and in the reenactment, Paul gets up to the driver's side window, sticks a gun in Chris's face, and tells Teresa to get out of the car. Chris tells Paul to stop, and they struggle over the gun. Chris grabs the gun through the driver's side window, and after struggling over it for a second, Paul gets control of the gun and shoots Chris. Then he runs around to Teresa's side of the car and threatens to shoot her if she doesn't open her door. So she opens it and he grabs her around her neck and drags her out of the car. Teresa says that at that point, Chris had come to and was yelling to Teresa not to leave him on the side of the road, which is gut-wrenching.
And she says
that there was nothing that she could do.
Well, and in the reenactment, he's like, get out, and she's trying to help him.
Well, and she's saying, you just shot him. Like, you just murdered somebody. What are you doing?
God, that's awful, awful, awful.
So horrible.
And then, so as far as Teresa knew, throughout this ordeal that she's about to enter into, she thought that Chris was dead.
Yeah.
So she thought that her ex-husband had murdered her boyfriend in front of her. Mm-hmm. So Stack says that sheriff's deputies were summoned by passing motorists, and when they arrived, Chris Butler was in critical condition. The bullet had punctured his heart, pancreas, spleen, and lung.
Oh, my God.
But miraculously, he survived.
Seriously amazing.
How?
Amazing. I guess he shot him downward, and he was sitting, so it just flew through all of these organs.
God.
Paul Stamper held a gun to Teresa and headed north. 2 days later, they stopped at a restaurant just outside of Topeka, Kansas. At the restaurant, Teresa tells Paul that she has to go to the bathroom. Teresa says that she walked toward the restroom and she was looking backwards to see if Paul was following her. He wasn't, so she ran to the manager's office and got him to call the police. In the reenactment, the manager is on the phone and he says, quote, hey, can you come by here? I got a crazy lady here.
Hated that. I really hope that was ad-libbing and not real, because what the fuck?
I'm assuming it's based on some truth, since Teresa was able to give a firsthand account of the situation.
And there's no reason for him to say that.
No. Oh, can you believe this crazy lady who's been emotionally, physically, and psychologically abused for the last 3 years? Watched her boyfriend get shot by this guy, and now she's kidnapped, and she's behaving a little crazy. Can you just come and get her?
I was so mad. Oh my God. So annoying.
Please believe women. Just believe them. By the time police arrived, Paul Stamper had vanished. 5 hours later, police caught up with Paul as he boarded a bus in Salina, Kansas. He was returned to Kingfisher County and held in the county jail to await trial. Stack says that 6 months later, at 3:30 in the morning, a man who had been offered $10,000 by Stamper broke into the Kingfisher County Jail. He put a gun to the guard and he forced her to unlock the cell door. Then Stamper comes out and they put the guard in.
It is like a cartoon. It's like Andy Griffith's show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She's like, oh my God.
Well, and I was concerned they just locked this female prison guard in a room with a bunch of other inmates.
Yeah, me too.
Horrifying. Yep.
But don't worry. I have information about that, because made a point to look up what happened to this female prison guard, and I hoped that nothing bad had happened to her.
Me too.
Also, how does he have all these contacts? Mm-hmm. He had this contact that could break into this jail for $10,000. He hired someone to kill.
Well, I don't want to generalize, but working on an oil field in the 1980s, it was a lot of transient sort of people who went from location to location. You didn't have to have a clean record, or you didn't have to pass a drug test to work in these places.
Yeah.
So it attracted a certain type of person.
God.
And in this case, Paul met the man who broke him out in the prison that they were housed in. So, you know, he's just dealing. I mean, he had a record. He's just always kind of been dealing with, like, not desirable section of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And it did come to light later that, and I'll get to this, but he was stealing equipment from oil fields at night. So he just generally ran with a shitty crowd.
Yeah. Wow.
So they put the guard in, and as of this airing, Paul Stamper escaped and had not been seen since. Sheriff Danny Graham says that he considers Paul Stamper extremely dangerous.
Yes.
He's like, yes, thank
mm-hmm. And all his friends and anyone
and
he might
and everyone
hang out
he
with.
Knows.
Yeah. All his buds.
Graham says that Stamper knows he's going to get life in prison once he's caught, and a desperate person will do desperate things.
Yeah.
Teresa says that Paul is out there somewhere watching her. She hopes he doesn't know where she lives now, but she says she doesn't think it's right that he's out there and maybe doing it to somebody else.
Ugh.
I know. I was like, she's brave to even be on the show, honestly.
Yeah.
Yes. Stack tells us, oh, so then there's an update. And Stack tells us that minutes after the story aired, the FBI received information from several viewers that Paul Stamper was living in Commerce City, a suburb of Denver, Colorado. Robert LePence of the Denver FBI says that one tip was very specific. The person knew the name of his alias, which was Gary Wickle, and the tip had Stamper's location, his address, his employment, and that he was driving a semi-truck. The FBI moved on the tip, and within the hour, Stamper was arrested. Stack says just 3 hours after the broadcast, Paul Stamper was arrested as he left his home. Stamper had been living in the Denver area under the alias Gary Wickle for approximately 4 years. Robert LePence says that this is the I love this. Robert LePence said that this was one of their more efficient, cost-effective, speedy apprehensions that they've ever made. He is, like, so thrilled about it.
So happy for you.
He's like, we crushed that, you guys. He's like, we crushed
barely it. Barely had to do anything.
He basically walked into us. Paul Stamper was extradited back to Oklahoma, where he pled guilty to kidnapping, attempted murder, and prison escape. Stamper was sentenced to 35 years in prison and was released after only serving 10.
Oh, my God.
So, strangely, there is very little about this case. I searched for articles and only found a few, and it was really only about Stamper's capture. Lucky for me, there was a pretty good, for the time, Lifetime movie made.
Really?
Called Escape from Terror, The Teresa Stamper Story.
Oh, wow.
It actually was produced by Cosgrove Muir. Mm-hmm. So I think the official title was From Unsolved Mystery Files, Escape from Terror, The Teresa Stamper Story.
Okay.
The movie starred Adam Stork, who I knew him. He played Larry Underwood in the Stand miniseries from 1994. Brad Dourif, who played Doc Cochran in one of my favorite TV shows of all time, Deadwood. And Cindy Williams, who was in Laverne and Shirley.
Oh, my
God. Love.
And then the woman who played Teresa Stamper, her name is Maria Patillo. I have no idea who she is. I didn't recognize her. She's just like your average pretty blonde white lady actress. She like looks like a lot of women actresses from the 90s that were in Lifetime movies, but she doesn't really have a lot of other like credits.
Yeah, I recognize her, but I don't really know what from.
She looks like Gretchen Mull, the actress Gretchen Mull. So that's who I thought it was initially, but it's this woman, Maria Patillo. So I cannot communicate enough how much more attractive Adam Stork is than the real Paul Stamper.
Lifetime loves to do that.
Oh my gosh. Paul Stamper looks like a weasel. And this actor, Adam Stork, walks around in a muscle tee. He's got long, cool guy hair, 90s hair. Obviously, I know why they did that. Lifetime.
Yeah.
That's what they did. You know, you have to like, you got to sex it up. There were a couple implied sex scenes. But it would have been a more interesting choice to make Paul Stamper not attractive, because it speaks to what we were saying earlier, Carlin. These guys have the ability to get these beautiful women.
Yeah, Teresa was gorgeous. Oh, my God.
I think it'd be a more interesting choice to have a conversation about what is it with these men and their ability to manipulate and find these specific women that a woman like Teresa Stamper would end up with this tiny, weaselly man like Paul Stamper. But, you know, you need a hottie in those Lifetime movies. You gotta get the juices flowing for the housewives at home.
You gotta.
The juices flowing.
For the housewives at home, honey.
For the housewives at home, honey. Come on. So at first, I wasn't going to watch the film because why would I? But then I read that. I'm not a Lifetime movie girl. Like, just never been my thing.
No, I was going to say that I was surprised you watched it.
Yeah, I know that there are some women out there that love a Lifetime movie, and I have seen many a Lifetime movie, but it's not my shtick. Yeah. It's not my guilty pleasure.
Yeah, no.
But then there wasn't any information out there. I was going through newspaper articles. I just couldn't find anything that involved what happened at the time. Because I guess, spoiler alert, women are harassed by their ex-husbands all the time. It is not newsworthy. I also looked into it, and from what I could tell, the facts of the story in the movie are very close to what actually happened, and it gave a lot more information. So I watched it, and I watched it at double speed.
Yes, so smart. Of course
you did.
I want to shout out my amazing partner, Jamie, who gave me a video plugin to watch videos at 2.5 times the speed, and it is going to be a life changer.
Actually, I need that too, but if anyone would, it is Jamie.
Oh, of course.
King of double speed.
Thanks, babe. Shout out. You're the best.
Wait, so this plugin then works on what video platform?
Yes.
Everything?
It works on YouTube. It works on Amazon. What? It works on everything.
Okay. Dream, which is a dream. For this job that we do. Oh my gosh.
Yes. Yes. Some parts are so slow. Oh my gosh. Slow. Yeah. So it's going to be a life changer, and I'll send it to you.
Great.
All right. So here's some more information. I'm just going to kind of go through the story a little bit, but add some more stuff throughout. So Paul and Teresa met in Hennessy, Oklahoma in 1982. She applied to be his secretary, and she had no work experience. She had previously worked in a gas station. But
you don't need any work experience when you're hot.
Exactly. Exactly. So like we said, the real Teresa Stamper is gorgeous. Yeah. So I think Paul went with her not having experience so that he could hang with a really hot girl all day.
Yep. Well, and then it also is just like that immediate power dynamic that they have.
Yes.
That's
absolutely true.
Yeah.
And then he's buying her stuff and she feels indebted to him.
Oh, it's textbook. It's textbook.
Yeah. Yeah, like you're not going to break up with someone who bought you a fucking Corvette or
a
whatever
car.
He bought.
Yeah.
And she came from poverty. So, you know, she always felt not good enough. She always wanted really nice things and didn't feel like she deserved them.
Yeah.
And initially, Paul was this hero for her.
Right.
He built Teresa up. He would tell her that she was just as good as the rich people in the town. And he had come from poverty and he had made something of himself and she could too. There wasn't anything that she couldn't do. Mm. She admired him. After he hired her, of course, you know, it's an oil field. There were all these dudes that were hitting on her, and Stamper would call them out and tell them to leave her alone. And so he was like a hero, and he would take her places on a whim. He was super spontaneous, and she had never left that town. She just was born and raised in this town. She's 20 years old. I mean, he probably seemed like magic.
Yeah, totally.
And Paul did get her a Corvette for her birthday, but he also attached an engagement ring to the keychain that he put in the ignition.
Oh, God.
Why would they not put that in UM?
Yeah.
And listen to this. So he tells her to go outside. There's the ring on the keychain. And then he pulls up, poses to her. She says yes. And he says, go pack your bag because we're flying to Vegas to get married tonight. Ugh. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Just that. It's like that love bombing, chaos of love where you're not even given a minute to think.
Yes.
You're not given a minute.
I'd still be processing you bought me a car and then like this other stuff.
That's what it is. It's like a blitzkrieg of quote unquote love.
Yeah.
That is so overwhelming and it's so toxic.
Oh, God.
So they were married in February 1983. They met in 1982. Mm-hmm. So at the most, they only dated for a year. Mm-hmm. But I think they dated for more like 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. God.
So they go to Vegas. I think they're only there for a few days. And the day they get home from Vegas the next morning, Teresa shows up to work. And Paul had fired her and hired someone else without telling her.
Mm.
So she tells him that she wants to work. He says, oh, you don't have to work now. You're a married woman.
No. Oh, my God.
I'll take care of you. And she said, well, you should have talked to me about it. And as they're arguing about it, he hits her in the face.
Yeah. So he's just immediately taking all the control.
When they said that the abuse happened quickly, they were not kidding. It was truly about 72 hours after they were married.
Yeah. Oh, and he took away her independence, too, because she
didn't
have a
job.
And yeah.
Exactly.
And her being able to communicate with other people at
anybody.
Work and
totally isolates her as they do.
Oh, dick bitch.
So after he hits her, Teresa went to her mother's and stayed at her mother's. Mm. But Paul showed up with flowers and apologized. Mm. He tells her, you're the best thing that ever happened to me. I can't live without you. I'm so sorry. I'm under a lot of stress at work. Again, the playbook, play by play.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
She tells him it can't happen again. He says it will never happen again. And that's how it goes for millions of men and women in these situations. Mm. Teresa forgives him, and he buys her the nicest house in this wealthy neighborhood, which is something that she's always wanted.
Mm-hmm.
The day she forgives him, he drives her to the home that he already bought her while they were in this argument.
Mm.
So he had so much confidence he could get
I
her
mean,
back.
He just knew. Yeah. He knew that he had her.
Immediately.
He knew
Look what I'm doing for you. Look at all I've done for you.
Mm-hmm. Look at all the nice things I give you. This is something huge that UM left out. In 1985, Paul and Teresa had a daughter.
Oh.
They named her Katie. And while I was watching the segment, I remember being relieved that at least they didn't have a kid or children mixed up in this awful scenario. But they did.
Oh, my God. Why would you have not put that in?
Maybe Teresa asked them not to.
Maybe just to protect
Maybe
the child?
Maybe she didn't want
I think to protect her.
Yeah.
After Teresa had Katie, Paul started working nights. And it's implied that he is stealing parts from these oil wells so that he can take the serial numbers off and resell them to the people that he's supplying. So Paul began to stay out days at a time. At some point, Teresa talked to his coworker. He told her that Paul was using drugs. And he also told her that the nights he was out working late, he was stealing from the oil fields. Teresa later found Paul in a bathroom shooting up. And he was furious that she walked in on him, and he hit her so hard that she collapsed.
Oh, my God.
So she had gone to the sheriff, of course, over the years. And while he was sympathetic, he told her that if no one was witness to the abuse, they couldn't prosecute, which is basically what he said in the segment. And I found out at the time in Oklahoma, if a woman was being abused by her partner, there had to be a witness in order to be able to arrest the abuser.
Oh, my God.
Imagine.
That is awful.
I know. It's disgusting.
That is literally saying, we don't believe you.
Yeah. I know.
Jesus Christ.
The sheriff told Teresa to get a protective order, which we now know does absolutely nothing for someone like Paul Stamper. Mm-hmm. Teresa again moved back in with her mother and took Katie, but Paul harassed her day and night. He called her constantly and again shot out her bedroom window. The movie doesn't show the instance where the man broke into the house and stabbed her friend, and I can only assume it's because the friend didn't want that information included.
Mm-hmm.
Teresa filed for divorce, and Paul began to threaten to kill her and himself. Teresa was able to get that protective order only because she recorded his threatening phone calls, and they were played in court.
Wow.
So Teresa and Chris Butler began dating, like we saw in the segment. Paul pretended to be a police officer to pull them over. He shot Chris and kidnapped Teresa. During the two-day ordeal, Paul continually threatened Teresa with a gun, threatened to kill her, threatened to kill himself, threatened to kill both of them. And it seems like for those 2 days, they were just sort of on the road driving aimlessly. Teresa ran from him in the diner, and they called the police. They determined that he was on a bus headed to Kansas City. They pulled the bus over, and they arrested him on the bus. Paul was broken out of the Kingfisher County Jail in April of 1986. This isn't in the reenactment in only a few minutes, and it's only a few minutes in the movie, but I read an article about the escape. After his arrest, Stamper began plotting his escape with a jail trustee named Guadalupe Peña. I didn't know what a trustee was. I guess it's an inmate that they allow freedoms to because they trust him. Peña told authorities that Stamper promised him $10,000 if he helped him escape. So on the day Peña was released, he got a gun, returned to the jail, and hid in an office area until only one jailer was on duty. Peña broke through a first-floor window while Lois Darling, the jailer, was on duty. Darling was on a second-floor cell block making a routine check of the inmates at about 3:30 in the morning. Stamper asked jailer Lois Darling for some chewing tobacco minutes before the gunman, wearing a ski goggles over a ski mask, came behind the jailer and ordered her to release Stamper. She hesitated but cooperated after the gunman jabbed a handgun into her neck.
Why is there a jailer working alone in a men's prison, especially a woman?
At 3:30
in the middle of the night.
Understand.
I mean, I think we can all safely say that that probably does not happen anymore.
Oh, my God.
And this guy, the trustee, did it for money, you said?
Yeah, 10 grand.
$10,000.
Which is, I was like, why do you want to risk all this for...
Well,
somebody
and that's
else.
The same amount of money that Stamper paid Gary Trout or offered Gary Trout to murder Teresa. So 10 grand was his magic number, apparently. So when Lois opened the cell door, Stamper reached out, grabbed her, pulled her into his cell, and then locked the cell door.
So scary to be her.
Horrible.
Four other inmates held inside the same cell with Stamper made no attempt to escape. And two of those prisoners helped by getting a description of the car and assisting Lois Darling in breaking open a cell window to get the attention of a convenience store employee across the street to call for help.
Oh, wow.
Yep. About an hour elapsed before their cries for help were heard. And Kingfisher police were summoned to free Darling from the cell. Hmm. So not only did they not hurt her or abuse her in any way, but they helped her, which
that's nice. Like, if they're trapped in there, everybody's going to know they did it if they did it, so.
Yeah. And who knows? They could have been in there on, like, theft or something not violent.
Totally.
Just think of male prisoners locked in a room with a female prison guard. Obviously, you go to a dark place. And then the article said, no one was hurt during the incident, although jailer Lois Darling was shaken up. Ugh. And I bet she was.
Oh, my God.
So Stamper promised to pay Pena at an Oklahoma City motel, but never showed up. Pena called Stamper's office to see where Paul was, and Sheriff Graham was there at the office seizing Stamper's information, his computers and files. So the secretary tells Graham, who's on the phone, and then the secretary asks Pena where he was. Pena told her, and Graham just went to the hotel and arrested him. Pena was convicted and served a 7-year prison term. So in June of 1986, Teresa, her mother Wanda, and her baby Katie were hiding in Norman, Oklahoma. Paul followed Chris Butler to the house to get the location of where they were living and then stole a set of keys from Wanda's car. Mm. At some point, he went into the home while Teresa was sleeping in the middle of the night, held the baby, and left flowers for Teresa.
No.
Terrifying. No. Later, he called Teresa and told her to meet him at a local bowling alley. But when he saw that she was with FBI agents, he never showed. Teresa finally made the difficult decision to move away to Nashville, Tennessee. So 5 years goes by and nothing happens. And then in 1991, on Katie's birthday, Paul called and told Teresa that he was watching Katie at school.
Oh, God.
He's like a monster, right? It's like a monster.
Horrible. Especially because there's a kid involved. Yes. Like, you'd be scared enough for yourself that this guy's going to follow you around forever, but you can't be with your kid all the time. Ugh.
Yeah, it just takes it to another level. So Teresa went to the FBI after the phone calls, but there wasn't much that they could do because they didn't know where Paul was. So they approached Teresa about putting Paul on Unsolved Mysteries.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Teresa's mother, Wanda, didn't want to do the show, but Teresa knew that if Paul wasn't caught, he would harass them and possibly eventually kill them all.
Oh, gosh.
And then in a peak meta moment, I'm watching something where the actors are watching Unsolved Mysteries in a Lifetime movie I was watching for a segment I was researching for Unsolved Mysteries.
Oh, my God.
Inception. It's Inception.
I love it. Yeah, it's pop culture Inception, and I'm here for it. I was like, you know what? This is a dream for me.
Honestly,
I am the happiest I have been all week.
That's amazing.
It's like that just dragging Amy and so in tail.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, like Ouroboros. Yeah. Yes. It was just like, I was like, this is it. It doesn't get any better than this for me. Yes. This is like my pop culture wet dream, truly, truly. So the night the show aired, at 8:14 p.m., a man called and said that Paul Stamper was Gary Wickle and that he had kidnapped the man's sister-in-law and took her out of state, forced her to marry him, and told her he'd kill her and her entire family if she didn't. He told Sheriff Graham, so Sheriff Graham was in the call center that night. He told Sheriff Graham that Paul worked for Tri-County Trucking in Commerce City, Colorado. Then literally 20 minutes later at 8:34 p.m., a woman called and said that she had been with Paul for a couple of years and that he kidnapped her. She said that she never wanted him to find her again, so she wouldn't give her name. What isn't clear is if this is the sister-in-law of the previous caller or if this is yet another woman that Paul Stamper had kidnapped. She was able to confirm that Paul was a trucker in Commerce City, Colorado, and she mentioned that he had a tattoo that said cowboy on his forearm.
Okay. Okay.
All right, Kid Rock. Simmer down.
Just literally labeling yourself.
I hate it. And he is not, he does not look like a cowboy.
He's not. Because if you are, that's fine. I'm okay with it. But
oh, my God. Cowboys are hot. Yeah. I will take a cowboy. I will not take a cowboy that looks like Kip from Napoleon
Dynamite.
And also,
if you are a cowboy, you're not tattooing that on yourself.
Yeah. No. I feel like if you're a cowboy, you don't need to write it on your body. Like, people just know, you know?
It's the definition of poser. Come on.
Truly. So now, law enforcement had two callers say the same thing, which we now know is how law enforcement decides if a tip is credible or not, if they get similar information about similar locations. Then a third person called the telecenter and said that Paul had just been at his house 30 minutes before the show started. The caller didn't know Stamper's address, but he did know where he lived. Sheriff Graham asked the man to show law enforcement where Stamper lived, and the man said, "Stamper wasn't someone you wanted to mess with." But Sheriff Graham was able to convince the man to show them the house. So at 9:34 p.m., an hour and 15 minutes after this airs, Central Time, Paul Stamper was arrested outside of his very pregnant girlfriend's home.
No!
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Super pregnant.
Oh, God.
And then I read an article in the Oklahoman from 1990, and apparently the jail was renovated and remodeled after Stamper's 1986 escape. Kingfisher County Sheriff Danny Graham said that Paul Eugene Stamper hardly recognized the place.
I mean, probably a great idea.
Yeah, quote, "We changed everything here security-wise," Graham said. That's what he said when he walked in. He said, "My God, it's changed."
Oh, my gosh.
Graham said that Stamper was, quote, "real cooperative." Quote, "It just seemed like he wanted to come back and get it over with." FBI agents said that they received more than 300 telephone calls on his whereabouts after the segment on Stamper aired.
Oh, my God.
So as we saw in the update, Stamper received a 35-year sentence, but he was released in 10. He was paroled in 2002. A lot of people were wondering about that on the message boards, so a user named KADRMAS15 explained, quote, "Stamper was sentenced under 1985 laws, which were different in Oklahoma than current laws. Stamper had a plea deal and was sentenced to 30 years in prison for attempted murder and kidnapping. He became eligible for parole under the old laws after serving 5 years. He was turned down the first two times, and on the third time, he was granted parole. He was released from prison on January 23, 2002, after having served 10 years. It is unclear whether he is still under supervised parole. It appears that he is no longer on parole itself, but is on probation and will be on probation until April 21st, 2027.
Mm. What's the difference between parole and probation?
I guess parole, you have to check in with a parole officer, and probation, you do not have to do that. But if you get arrested again, the charges are a lot heavier than they would have been if you weren't on probation.
Right, okay.
This person goes on, basically it was mandated at the time he was sentenced that whenever he was paroled from prison, even after his parole was discharged, he would still be on probation for 25 years after his release from prison.
For 25 years? Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. But probation, really, it's not parole. You don't have to check in with anybody.
Right.
It's just trying to encourage you not to
commit more crimes.
But it's like, you know what? These guys, he doesn't give a shit.
They don't fucking care. They don't care.
He thinks he's not going to get caught. So, of course, he's going to commit something else.
Yeah.
So I wasn't able to find anything on Paul, Teresa, or Katie Stamper that was recent. Obviously, Teresa and Katie are probably keeping a very low profile. But I did find that Paul kept on being a human dumpster fire after he was paroled in 2002.
Shocking.
In 2005, he was arrested for, you guessed it, domestic violence.
Oh, my God. He can't not.
In 2013, he was arrested again for possession of a controlled substance. I don't know where Teresa and Katie are, but I truly hope that they were able to get some sort of help for the tremendous amounts of PTSD that they must have suffered.
Yeah. I'm sure they've changed their names.
Oh, yeah. Yes. But, yeah, that's it. That's Paul Stamper. Fucking
absolute
piece of shit.
Dick bitch.
Piece of shit. It truly was like a TV show, which I'm surprised Lifetime didn't put in the shooting of the boyfriend, because that...
No, they put in the shooting of the boyfriend. They didn't put in the stabbing of the friend on the couch.
Yeah.
Which I think probably the friend was like, I don't want this.
Yeah.
I don't need this.
Yeah.
So that one, did he not know that his wife wasn't going to be at the house? Obviously he didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, he hired Gary Trout. He didn't know that his wife wasn't going to be home. What are the odds of someone else staying in her, a woman staying in the house? Ugh. And then I read that it wasn't in the couch. He went into the bedroom and he sat there.
That would make
a
lot more sense. Because I think if somebody was sleeping on the couch, you'd be like, wait a minute. Is this the right person?
I feel like Gary Trout wasn't the brightest crayon on the box. So he just saw long hair and started stabbing.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
What a brutal, brutal situation for this poor woman and her daughter and her mother.
Atrocious.
She probably thought she was going to die so many times. Ugh.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That's
terrible.
Horrifying.
Dick bitch.
We don't like it. We don't like
it. We hate it.
All right. So, we got a scammy scammer. We haven't had a scammer in a while, it seems.
I love a lady mm-hmm. scammer. I mean, I hate her.
We've had some fraud, but this is like legit acting, con mm-hmm. artist scams. Okay, so this is the story of Josephine White, who also has the aliases Judith Hunt, Denise C., or Judith Campbell. And she's wanted for fraud. And oh my goodness, this segment is just... You feel so bad for the victim.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, I think I've said this my last five segments. The person reenacting Josephine White was incredible. Mm-hmm. She was so good.
Yeah, she was great.
So this is a con artist who uses the pigeon drop as their main scam.
The old pigeon drop.
And I hadn't heard it called that. We will get into how the segment describes it, but I'll also just read you the wiki definition of what a pigeon drop is.
Oh,
it's also known as the Spanish handkerchief.
Yes.
Okay.
But it's a confidence trick in which a mark or pigeon or victim is persuaded to give up a sum of money in order to secure the rights to a much larger sum of money or more valuable object.
Classic.
And it always takes two con artists, so two people are posing as strangers to each other, mm-hmm. and they manipulate the mark in some way, usually saying they found a large amount of lost money, that they really want to keep it. Then they get the mark involved somehow, which is the part that a lot of people on like sitcoms online are like, oh, I could never fall for that. I would just never fall for that. Why would they need to include me, a stranger, in it? And it's just like, you don't know how they pick the right people. Mm-hmm. And as we'll get into.
Yes. And I was going to say, I would 100% fall for it when the second person became involved.
Yeah.
Because I'd be like, oh, there's no way this is fake if this rando is here. You know?
Yeah. And they, yeah. I'll get back to a couple of pop culture uses of the pigeon drop in some of our favorite TV shows.
Fun.
Okay, so Josephine White is wanted for performing the pigeon drop several times, and she is thought to have stolen nearly $1 million from mostly retired citizens using this scam. She has allegedly been perpetrating the scam since 1963.
Damn.
She has so many disguises. We get to see her putting on some different wigs. She uses jewelry. She uses nice clothes. And Stack says that this, one of the investigators says, this is a tactic that con artists use so that the victims don't look closely at the face. Mm-hmm. But they're looking at the hair. They're looking at the rings and the nice jewelry and their nice shoes that they're wearing, mm-hmm. which we've seen this before, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So the main victim that they talk about in this segment is Barbara, not her real name, but she was an immigrant who did not have a full command of English, as they say in the segment. And she is a retired hospital worker who volunteers now, and she just lives on a very small pension. Mm. On April 26, 1989, she met Barbara in a parking lot, and Barbara comes running up to her, the reenactor, and she's acting very, like, excited and nervous, and she says, look, you've got to see what I found, you've got to see what I found, and she has this little pocketbook, and she opens it, and there's just tons of cash in it.
Mm.
And Barbara, with her, like, sweet accent in the reenactment, is like, oh, okay, like, I don't know how to help. I don't know what you want me to do, basically.
Yeah, she's like, I don't want to be involved.
No, yeah. When Josephine realizes, oh, this is not going to be enough to, like, hook her, she says, okay, but look at what I also found in here, and pulls out a note from the same bag, and the note reads, dear brother, we've done it again, this time at the racetrack. I've enclosed the money and sent it this way to avoid paying income tax. Jose. And so it's just like getting more earnest and convoluted for Barbara. Mm-hmm. She's still kind of, and Josephine is like, what do you think we should do? What should we do? And when you know about this scam and you also are not like someone who, you are someone who speaks English fully and that's your only language, or you have a, you know, good command of it, it's like, oh my God, shut up. We don't need to do any, like, why are you so, when you're on the outside of it, it's so obvious, but mm-hmm, yeah, you can see how she would, Barbara would be like, I don't know what to do.
Well, and Josephine is just kind of relentless with everything.
Yes, like, and just panicking.
Yeah, even if Barbara doesn't want to do anything, she just keeps going.
Yeah. So then shortly after showing her the note, a man walks up and he says, there seems to be something going on. Is there something I can help you with, ladies? And this is, of course, the second mm-hmm con artist. And Josephine and him do know each other, but it looks to Barbara like they're strangers, mm-hmm, which, when has anyone ever walked up to two women and said, can I help you? Never. That's so that true. Should be the first sign.
That's a red flag.
So Josephine explains to this man what, you know, it all over again, shows him all the money, and she says, okay, I know what we should do. My boss is an expert in taxes, and he deals with finance. He'll know what to do, but we all need to drive there to go ask him what should we do with this money, because we want to keep it, but we don't know if that's the right thing to do. And by this time, Barbara has been saying, I think we need to go to the police. Mm-hmm. And Josephine's like, no. If we go to the police, we won't be able to keep it. And then so they convince her to get in the car with them. Mm. And during the car ride, the man, who apparently is a stranger, but this woman's willing to let him get in the car, is saying all this horrible stuff going on with him, how much he needs this money, how this is just the best day of his life, mm-hmm, because his wife has stomach cancer.
Oh, God.
And
yeah,
this is just meant to be that he found all this money and he really hopes that they can keep it.
So at that point, you're a bad person if you don't help.
Exactly. Yes. So, yeah, this convinced Barbara even more to help them because they're all just saying, oh, my gosh, how much we could use this money. And Barbara, of all of them, is the one who could use the money.
Mm. Seriously.
So they arrive at this office building and Josephine says, okay, I'm going to go inside and talk to my boss. And so leaves the man and Barbara out in the car. And again, Barbara's like, I just think that we need to go to the police. And the man says, if we go to the police, we won't get the money. We need to just wait and see what she says. So Josephine comes back and she's all excited and says that her boss said they could legally keep the money and they'd each get $22,000 if they were splitting it three ways. And at this point, it's all, when you're on the outside, it's also like she would not let this third man come along.
Yeah.
She split the money three ways.
Exactly.
She'd just want to split it two ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it were true. Also, she wouldn't have come up to Barbara. She just wanted to keep it all.
The money.
Yeah. So, but she says that her boss says, but we have to put down a $5,000 good faith deposit for income tax purposes. Whatever that could mean. Obviously, it's fake. But it's basically saying if you put down this $5,000, you will get your $22,000 and your $5,000 back. But the IRS just wants you to have this like on file, basically.
Okay. I don't know. That's definitely how taxes work.
Yeah. And, you know, the IRS always works on good faith.
Yeah.
They love a good faith deposit.
No, we know you're good for it. We know. You know what? Take back that $5,000 and here's $22,000.
Back to you. Yeah. So Josephine and the man, her accomplice, then tell, oh my gosh, yeah. So Josephine's like, so do you have a credit card on you? And Barbara's like, no, I don't. And they're like, oh, that's okay. We'll drive you to your house and you can just pick up your checkbook. And so Barbara's still kind of like, okay, like unsure, but kind of getting more excited at the thought of having $22,000.
Sure.
So they drive her to her home, they get her checkbook, then they take her to the bank. And at the bank, she withdrew $5,000, which is almost all the money that she had.
Mm.
And the bank teller's like, okay, you really want to withdraw it all? And she's like, yeah, I do. And so she gets it in hundreds in cash and she gives it to Josephine. So then They return to the same office building that they had been to. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, this part is horrible.
I know, it's heartbreaking.
Horrible. Josephine says she's going to go in first. She says that she's going to show the money to her boss. And then she comes back out to the car and she tells Barbara, okay, you get to go in now too. And you just are going to show the money. So it's your good faith deposit. And then you come right back out and we can all split the money. And she says, like, go to room 242 or something. And so Barbara goes up and she finds room 242. Aww. And when she goes to turn the knob, it is locked. And she's like knocking on the door and no one is answering. And you can sense that probably this is a moment of like your heart dropping if you are Barbara.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, because you gave the money. Yeah, I can't actually remember what she told her she was going to go do. Just meet with the boss, I think.
Yeah.
But she had given the money to Josephine in the car.
Yeah.
So she's waiting around. No one comes. She goes back outside and Josephine's car is gone. So not only do they take her money, but they also leave her stranded.
Yeah. And you can tell she just feels so dumb as soon as she sees they're gone. Ugh.
Yes, that is the saddest part. And this happens. This is still happening with... Mm-hmm. Older people, scammers target them, and then older people don't want to tell their kids that this happened because they are afraid their kids will think like, oh, you have something's wrong with you, or she says, I was afraid my son would want to put me in a home, like I wasn't capable of living on my own anymore. Mm-hmm. Oh, God, it's heartbreaking.
It is. Terrible.
And it's happening so much now, especially with technology changing.
Oh, it almost happened to my grandmother. It would have happened to my grandmother if one of my relatives wasn't at her house.
And they make it sound so urgent. Mm-hmm. The scammers are like, this has to happen right now so that you don't have time to think about it.
Exactly.
Oh, gosh. So Barbara did the right thing, though, and went to the police, and they were able to determine that Josephine White was responsible. They have known about her, and then she also was believed to do the same scam again in Boston in September of 1991. And at the time, she's known to operate in the eastern United States and also in California. So, there isn't a lot more about the case, but basically I found an article from the Hartford Courant, which is obviously a Connecticut newspaper, and it's from October 31st, 1994. A Boston woman was sentenced to 15 years in prison after pleading guilty to stealing more than $35,000 from three residents of Manchester and East Hartford in a 1990 check cashing scam. Josephine White, who was 47, formerly of Waterford, pleaded guilty to two counts of first-degree larceny and one count of second-degree larceny. The charges stem from three cases in which White persuaded people to cash checks against their accounts for her on the false premise that they would receive huge sums of money in return. Her complicated scam, known as the pigeon drop, was often committed against elderly women whom White would approach as they went into a bank. Some of the checks were written for as much as $10,000. White also had been convicted of pulling off similar thefts in the Middletown and Meriden areas, as well as in Massachusetts and Rhode Island. She was arrested in the local cases last July. So in like 93 and then 94, she is arrested and then also charged in all these different accounts. I could not find how she was caught. We got an update from the UM segment, but it just said Josephine White was arrested during one of her scams. She pleaded guilty to three larceny charges and was sentenced to 15 years in prison. So it never said if this was from UM or since it was during one of her scams, I'm guessing it's just maybe the person caught on and called the police on her. But there is like no information on this case. I was able to find an obituary for a Josephine White in Connecticut, but I couldn't, but it was very like loving and she had lots of kids and a family that loved her. Not saying that this one wouldn't, but I couldn't tell if it was the same woman on the face. And so I'm not sure. Couple of other things. So, like I said on Sitcoms Online, so this one person, Roberts, who calls themselves Robert Stack Jr., excuse me very much, says, pigeon drop scam? Really? Okay, Josephine White and her accomplice were scumbags. Nobody is arguing that. I'm glad she was captured, and I hope he was too. But seriously, was that old lady one of UM's stupidest victims or what?
Oh my gosh.
A goofy, strange lady approaches you and tells you she found a big bag of money. She's going to share it with you even though she doesn't know you. Then she needs $5,000 to keep it. First of all, why couldn't they just take the $5,000 off the sum of money that's there and get it back when everything comes up legit? Number two, how is it that these two seemingly professional people can't come up with the money between them and need to use the old lady's life savings?
Yeah, it's really easy to think that way when you're not in the
moment.
When
you're on the outside.
And the woman said, too, that she said they talk so fast and everything moves so quickly that before you know it, you're involved in it and you don't know how you got there.
Like, they're moving quickly. They're laying on pressure. They're telling you their lives depend on it. Like, come on, man.
And then he says, number three, how effing stupid, naive, gullible are you that you would drain your bank account and give all your money to a complete stranger? Big deal that they showed you a large sum of money. None of that was signed over to you. It's just like, duh, they're not stupid. This is what a scam is.
Yes.
This is what, and they know how to pick.
They do it because it works on people.
Exactly. And if this woman is stupid and gullible, that means that millions of people are stupid and gullible because this happens all of the time.
Yes. Right. So fucking rude.
Yeah.
Okay, so then, but I liked this. This person, Neko, replied, this is so true. I loved what they said. Some people just have trouble conceiving of evil.
Yeah.
They do business on a handshake, not a 34-page legal contract.
It's true.
They believe that all people are inherently good.
That is what I was going to say.
Yeah. Is it naive? Yes. But I don't think it's fair to call someone stupid because they don't assume everyone's a con man.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, so I liked that, and I mean, there's not a lot of people talking about the case on there, but I just didn't, that guy was so rude.
Yeah.
Obviously. And then to the pigeon drop, so in pop culture, the pigeon drop has been used a few times. In The Golden Girls, season 5, episode Cheaters, Blanche and Sophia are victims of a pigeon drop at the mall.
I remember that episode! I remember that one!
And then in Better Call Saul season 1 episode 4, Jimmy uses a form of the pigeon drop with his friend Marco using fake Rolexes or rare coins as the lure. And then in the 2003 film Matchstick Men, Nicolas Cage attempts to pull a version off of the pigeon drop on a businessman, but it doesn't turn out well. So it makes me want to go back and watch
that. Yeah, I don't remember enough.
I think he gets beaten up.
Yeah, probably. So, yeah, it's an interesting one since it requires two people to act like they're strangers, which in some ways is more convincing. And then in other ways does provide more of a way that the victim might notice.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think you two actually know each other.
Yeah, so it is risky.
It could work either way.
It's risky.
Or it could go either way.
It's also, I mean, gosh, if she's stealing $5,000 and $10,000, she's been operating since the 1960s, and she's stolen over $1 million, that means that she's done this to hundreds of people at the very least.
Who knows? That's what Stack said. And that's the problem with scammers even today, is that people don't want to come forward.
No, they're embarrassed. Yeah.
That is probably a guess, but it might be an accurate guess.
Yeah, it's humiliating.
Of just who are all the people that haven't even come forward to say they were a victim of
it? Oh, for sure.
We've seen that people be in shadow before.
Yeah, because they're so embarrassed by it.
Well, yeah, and quote unquote Barbara was completely blurred out. Not even in shadow. She was all pixely. So we hate you, Josephine White. That's rude. Very rude.
I doubt that was her obituary.
I don't think so. It was the sweetest lady who's beloved by all 17 of her grandchildren.
Yeah, I'm thinking
all this.
Probably not.
I know.
All right.
Okay.
Good job.
All right, Cheersy Feelsies ladies, what do we got?
Carlin, do you have? I have a couple things. Feelings.
You have some thoughts and feels?
Every now and then I have a feeling.
Oh, I love it.
Well, camping was fun.
It was.
There was so much rain the first night, you guys.
It was a little wet.
We had a couple canopies that saved our butts, but...
Oh my gosh.
Some of us had some tent issues.
Hi, I had the tent issue. Hi, it's me.
So some of us got a little bit wet, but we still had fun.
No, it was super fun.
It was so fun.
And the second day was great. The second day was dry and lovely and...
We hung out. It was it was great. It was super fun. I can't wait to do it again.
And learned about s'mores, and it was cute. Mm-hmm. And then also, this was a Sherzy, I believe, last episode, but I started watching Mare of Easttown, and I am obsessed with it.
Isn't it so good?
Kate Winslet is a queen.
I know.
I know we said it last week, too, but she is so good.
She is everything. I love her.
And her character, it's just so good. We have two episodes left, but I love it.
Fun. I'm glad you started watching it.
Me too. Yeah,
so good.
I have a TV show recommendation. It's so fun. It's the Loki TV show on Disney. It has, I mean, I don't know if our listeners watch Marvel movies or, I mean, I feel like you can't have gone the last 20 years without seeing at least one. Tom Hiddleston plays Loki, and the show feels a lot like a Noah Hawley sort of like, Legion.
Yes, I said that too.
Vintage-y looking and interesting camera angles, and Owen Wilson's in it, and he's always great.
And
it's a lot of fun.
There's a reference in the first ep.
Yeah, so in the first episode, they allude to Loki being D.B. Cooper.
Which is and so funny.
So cute. Yeah. Cute. It's a lot of fun. Definitely recommend.
Love it. I have two. My first one is one I've already mentioned before, but this is actually happening, which is a Wondery podcast. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we love it, but I don't know if it always was.
It was not.
Okay.
It was not always, no.
I forgot about it, and so I've just been binging it, and it's fucking...
So good.
So good.
Yeah.
So
good. You have to listen to that one.
It's one of my faves.
So get on that. And then the most recent This American Life episode that really stuck with me is called Sisters. And it's just like three different stories of like bonds between sisters that are, of course, kind of unconventional, but just so beautiful and amazing. Aww. And This American Life is so, it just continues to be so good. So
yeah.
I recommend listening to that.
Awesome. Yeah. Review Corner. Who's doing Review Corner?
Have you gotten to do Review Corner yet?
I haven't. No.
You should do it.
I should do it?
Sure.
All right. I'll do Review Corner. So we have three reviews this week that we picked out. The first one, the title is True Crime with Heart, and it's by Kimmy Cat the Rope. This person says, I don't even listen on this app, but since I'm unable to review on the app I do listen to, I decided to install Apple Podcasts just to recommend this these amazing ladies. I grew up watching Unsolved Mysteries and true crime shows in general, and this podcast is everything I didn't know I needed. I love how they handle each topic with the compassion and delicacy that is so often lacking in the true crime genre while still managing to have lighthearted banter and laughter. Mm-hmm. I appreciate how very real it all feels, and their obvious friendship is such a charming addition to an already fantastic podcast. And y'all, there's updates. It is the perfect companion piece if you decide to watch Unsolved Mysteries, as they do a ton of research to provide much-needed context to the show that the show often doesn't provide. And sometimes their research makes a mess segment into something totally crazy and unexpected. I love this podcast. If you love true crime with some heart and some swear words to spice up the conversation, then this is the podcast for you.
So nice.
So nice.
So nice. I love Review Corner. It makes my heart so happy. The next one is Nostalgia with Updates, and it's from DMC Archeo 13. You ladies are rocking it. I grew up watching Unsolved Mysteries with my mom. Oh, so I love listening to your recaps and love the updates and further information. You're saving me hours and hours of falling down rabbit holes. Yep. You do your research, and your friendly banter is a lovely addition. Y'all are helping me get through my dissertation writing and commutes, so thank you. If you were a kid in the 90s, you gotta listen to these ladies.
Oh, so nice.
I know. I love that our listeners getting through dissertations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Smarty pants.
People are getting some major work done while they're listening to us.
Truly.
How are you guys
doing? A lot of home renovation, too, I think. And then the last one is, love it, even though I've never watched UM. I adore these oh, and this is from Bahadaway. I adore these ladies, and now I'm binging all the seasons and going to join their Patreon. I've always been true crime obsessed, but never watched the show Unsolved Mysteries. But when Resolved kept popping up in my podcast recommendations, I decided to give it a try, and I'm so glad I did. I love they also include these stories with happy endings, so you get a palate cleanse for the episodes that have not so great endings.
Because we need it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you, guys. That was so nice of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Okay. What are we covering next episode? Ooh, I go first.
Oh, you're first, girl.
I have a really sad lost loves, and it is the story of Delia Fazzani Goldie.
What a great name. And I've got a wanted segment about Jim Burnside.
And another lost loves, Jeff Fisher.
Oh. Double the love.
All right, guys, go to patreon.com/resolvedmysteriespodcast if you're interested in supporting us there. And if you subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher, you're going to get ad-free episodes, 2 extra episodes a month, and goodies in the mail. To see photos that we reference in the episode, follow us on Instagram at resolvedmysteriespodcast, on Facebook and Twitter at resolvedthepod, and you can contact us at resolvedmysteriespodcast.com. We promise it won't go to spam this time. And resolvemysteriespodcast@gmail.com or at our P.O. box, which we promise to also check, 14005 Portland, Oregon, 97293.
We need an intern.
Yeah. Anyone want to be our free intern?
Anybody want to do our stuff for us for no money? It's really, it's super fun.
And don't forget to send us some stories for listener short stack episodes. You guys can send us anything that you think would be interesting, unsolved mysteries, cold cases, anything you want. And subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like us, leave a 5-star review and maybe we'll read it on the show. And please tell a friend.
You got it. You got to tell a friend. You got to.
You got to.
Just tell someone.
It's the only way to grow. You got to tell somebody who's going to like the show. That's just how we grow. It's how we do. I looked into advertising on other podcasts, and it is so expensive that we just, you know, we can't spend $5,000.
We need you to advertise for us with your mouth.
Yeah. If we had $5,000, we wouldn't need to advertise.
Exactly.
How can we pigeon drop this situation?
Yeah, we need to pigeon drop this situation, but we need to do it to like a really wealthy, mean guy.
Yeah.
It's the only person we want to take advantage of.
Yeah, we need to pigeon drop Elon Musk or somebody.
All right. And don't forget, for every review we receive, we donate $1 to an organization. And for this month, that is the Epilepsy Foundation.
All right.
All righty.
Love ya.
We love you so.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Compassion and delicacy?
Yeah, delicacy.
Yeah, delicacy. Which is weird. That is a weird...
Because I want to eat that, don't yeah. I?
Yeah. Yeah, but it's... Yeah.
English is stupid.
English is so stupid, you guys.